Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Julia Gillette. I'm a senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, and I'm so glad you all have joined us for this webinar entitled "Excluding Millions: How Trump Administration Changes to the Decennial Census Could Leave Out U.S. Citizens and Immigrants." I'm going to start with just a couple of housekeeping notes. If you have any technical problems during the webinar, please email events@migrationpolicy.org or call 202-266-1929. We'll be having a question and answer session at the end of the call. There will not be voice Q&A, so please type any questions into the Q&A chat box on the right side of your screen and send to the host, or email questions to events@migrationpolicy.org. You can also tweet your questions to @migrationpolicy or using hashtag MPIDiscuss. The audio from today's webinar will be available at www.migrationpolicy.org/events. And you can check out our related commentary available on our website or at the link on your screen. So today, we have three great speakers who are going to help us understand what is happening with the 2020 census this year and the issues that it presents for immigrant families. First, we'll hear from Jennifer Van Hook, who is a professor of sociology and demography at Penn State, and who we're very lucky to have also as a non-resident fellow at MPI. Next, we'll hear from Kenneth Pruitt, who was the director of the U.S. Census Bureau from 1998 to 2001, and is now a professor of public affairs at Columbia University. And last, we'll hear from Dale Ho, director of the Voting Rights Project at the ACLU, who has been one of the key litigators in cases relating to the citizenship question on the census, and this year on apportionment questions around immigrants. Before we get to their comments, I'm just going to provide a bit of framing for the conversation today. We've seen that the 2020 census is shaping up to be one of the most contentious censuses that we've had in this country. Starting off, this is the first census to be conducted online, which raised questions of access, privacy, and security. And this census, of course, is happening now during a global pandemic. The COVID-19 outbreak in the U.S. has led many Americans to move unexpectedly across state lines in the middle of the census process. The outbreak has made non-response follow-up very difficult. As the non-response activities were delayed, the in-person visits to people who didn't answer the census voluntarily has been delayed, and it's been difficult for the Census Bureau to hire workers to do face-to-face in-person interviews, especially since they normally hire a number of retirees who face the greatest health risk. Data collection is now set to end on September 30th, just 35 days from now, and the latest response rate I've seen is currently in the low 70% range. What's unique also about the census this year is the way that the main controversies intersect with immigrant populations. In prior years, there were, of course, concerns that the Census Bureau accurately represent the immigrant population and that immigrants felt safe answering the census. But this year, we've seen two attempts by the Trump administration to treat immigrants differently in the census data. Last year, the administration tried to add a citizenship question to the census and was sued by advocates in a set of blue states. Eventually, the Supreme Court ruled that the administration had not adequately justified the need for the citizenship question. Following that, the administration said they would use administrative data records instead from the Social Security Administration, Department of Homeland Security, and others to identify the citizenship of all census respondents, and they said they would send to states a file just of citizens so that states, if they wanted, could potentially use that for apportionment of representation rather than the full count of residents. On top of that, last month, President Trump issued a memo announcing that when the administration formally delivers the counts of people living in each state to be used for allocating congressional seats across states, it would exclude unauthorized immigrants. Again, they plan to use administrative data to identify those unauthorized immigrants and match the administrative data with census responses. This, of course, has again led to litigation by a number of states' attorney generals and by some advocacy groups represented by the ACLU. All of these issues, both related to the pandemic and related to efforts to exclude immigrants from apportionment counts, have big implications for how well immigrant households and families are captured in the census data, and of course have big political ramifications. And this in turn has implications for the next 10 years in which states gain or lose congressional seats, in how government funding is allocated for Medicare, schools, roads, and other social services, for how governments and private groups and industry alike plan for the future, and for how well immigrant households are represented in all of the surveys that use the census as a benchmark for the data. So today we've brought together three experts who can give us an in-depth look at some of the implications and the legal questions around all of these changes. We're going to start with Jenny Van Hook. Last month, Jenny, my colleague Randy Capps, and I wrote a short piece explaining some of the challenges of using administrative data to identify unauthorized immigrants in census respondents. And Jenny will share some of this analysis and her own work and discuss what this might mean for coverage of immigrants in the census. So I'll turn things over to you, Jenny.
Okay, thank you so much, Julia. As I was thinking about what I was going to say, I was thinking, oh my goodness, there are so many things and issues related to the president's apportionment memo that are problematic that it's a little hard to kind of figure out where to start. There are serious questions about constitutionality and feasibility, and I'm sure we're going to hear about those things from our other speakers. What I really want to focus on with my time is a fear that I have that the impact of Trump's plan could extend far beyond the 10 or 11 million undocumented immigrants living in our country right now. Now, don't get me wrong, excluding that those immigrants would have a dramatic effect. It would shift the balance of political power. We already know from other studies that states like California, Texas, New Jersey could very well lose seats in the House because of this plan. But what I fear is that the impact could actually be much greater than that. It could extend to excluding people who are not only undocumented immigrants, but also U.S. citizens and legal immigrants. And it all boils down to the fact that there's just no foolproof way of knowing a person's immigration status in the census. And what this means then is that there's like a considerable amount of discretion involved in determining what those final numbers would be, opening up questions about the count and the degree to which politics has affected those numbers. So just to back up a little bit, some basic information here is that the census does not collect any information on citizenship or immigration status. So what they're doing is apparently is using administrative records to fill in this information. The census can do this because it collects information on name, date of birth, and address when it takes the census from people. And then it takes that information and links everybody to records held by various agencies like the Social Security Administration, tax records from the Internal Revenue Service, and records for, in the case of immigrants, from the Department of Homeland Security, which holds records on naturalizations and admissions. There's other agencies as well that are being tapped for this purpose, but the basic idea is to then assemble all of this information and then use it to identify a person's immigration and citizenship status. But there's three major problems that I want to highlight about this plan. First is that very little administrative data actually includes or identifies undocumented immigrants per se. And in many cases, like I said before, I think it can identify some U.S.-born citizens to be citizens, naturalized citizens from naturalization records and other records, and legal non-immigrants from admission records. But basically what this means then is that those who are not identified as belonging to one of those three groups, then by process of elimination could be counted or classified as undocumented. And this is not an actual enumeration of undocumented immigrants. And I think there's serious questions about whether this then would be allowed for the purposes of apportionment. Because the Supreme Court already ruled back in 1999 that actual enumerations are required for apportionment purposes. A second point that I wanted to make is that administrative data are notoriously messy. The information collected in them is often out of date. It's often inconsistent with other administrative records and with data that the Census Bureau collects itself. So it's going to be hard to know which sources of information to trust and which to disregard. And then finally, the third point I wanted to make is that not everybody can be matched to administrative data. And so, you know, to some degree, okay, so undocumented immigrants sometimes are not present in administrative data, so they can't be linked, and I've made that point already. But there's also a lot of other people who can't be linked because they did not provide sufficient personal identifying information, or that information that they did provide on their name or their date of birth is inaccurate. And so it becomes difficult then to make high quality data linkages with the administrative records. And just to get a sense of the scale of this problem, in 2018, the Census Bureau published a report in which it attempted to match the 2010 census respondents to administrative records. And in 9% of the cases, which amounted to 28 million people, the matches failed, or the census collected insufficient information to even attempt to match. And so if the same thing happens in 2020, which is probably something that's very plausible, then this year's census could fail to match as many as 30 million people. Now, the most credible estimates of the number of undocumented immigrants falls between 10 and 12 million. And so clearly not all of these unmatched people are undocumented. So that leaves 20 million people who are not undocumented. They probably are US born or legal non-citizens remaining who are unmatched and have missing information on the administrative record data. Now, to be sure, the Census Bureau has plans to fill in gaps using methods called statistical modeling, but their methodology is unclear at this point, and actually, frankly, there's been very little transparency or outside oversight as far as I can see. And the general idea, if I can kind of imagine what they're doing, is they're probably going to be assigning everybody a probability of being undocumented based on the administrative data. So a person might be assigned a probability like 0.2 or 0.7 on a scale between 0 and 1, and with a 1 being certainly that person is undocumented and a 0 being certainly they're legal. But there's going to be a lot of people falling in between in this sort of gray area. So next slide. So the main point I'm trying to make here is, where do you draw the line then? You know, where do you draw the line in terms of classifying somebody as being legal versus undocumented? Is it 0.2, 0.3? Is it something as high as 0.8 or 0.9? Clearly, you can see from this chart, these two charts, where you draw the line makes a big difference in terms of the numbers, the final counts. And so this really ends up leaving a lot of room for interpretation. It does make me concerned that you know, there's, you know, twice as many unmatched people as there are undocumented people. And so this does leave a lot of room for interpretation. So the bottom line is the administrative data is just too error prone and open to interpretation to rely on for apportionment, in my view. So, and that's it for now.
Great. Thank you very much, Jenny. That's really enlightening. Next up, I'll turn to Ken Pruitt. So Ken, given your experience running the Census Bureau and given all of the challenges facing the census this year, particularly this current effort to exclude unauthorized immigrants from apportionment, what is your assessment about how Census 2020 is going compared to prior censuses? How different is this year, and what are the implications, especially for coverage of immigrant households in the census?
Well, I'm going to start by just continuing with what Jenny just said. You have to understand about a census, it's a count. You go out, knock on doors, ask people to respond, send it in over the internet, and so forth. And then it ends as far as the public is concerned. But it has not ended because it's not been corrected. The census data themselves are, for some of the reasons that Jenny just mentioned, they have internal flaws through nobody's fault. That people forget, they put down the wrong address, or they use their weekend address rather than their house, their normal household address, or whatever. Huge problem this year with all of the students being relocated right in the middle as the census gets started, right in the middle. Thousands and thousands of kids living one place where they should be living, that is in the major place of residence at the university and colleges, and now going back home. So this is going to be an enormously difficult census to do quality control on. And they do not have enough time. Even to the best of will, you cannot squeeze 4 or 5 months of work into 2.5 months, which is what is being done right now. So when you evaluate the census, you have to say not only what was the number, but what's the ratio of accurate numbers to inaccurate numbers? And I guess a lot of attention is being given to that now in the press and so forth. So to start with, and it's certainly this is played out in spades with respect to the undocumented, who have reasons not to want to be counted, of course, certainly in this administration, where it's clear that they are vulnerable to being families split up and taken out of the country and so forth and so on. So they're not going to want to be counted under the best of circumstances. So it's a census with unusually high levels of mistrust, unusually high levels of quality problems that we don't have time to fix, and so forth. So I think that just to simplify, follow up on Jenny, she got it right, as far as I'm concerned, having watched this unfold. Now, another thing about the census today is a lot more people own it. You say, what do you mean, own it? Well, three censuses ago, the 2000 census, we launched what I now call a facelift for the census. And that facelift really meant bringing other actors into the conduct of the census itself. I'm now talking about things like complete count committees, partnerships, trusted voices. The country is flooded with a lot of people wanting to make a good census out of this, and working in diligent ways and intelligent ways and so forth. But they're actually not part of the census itself. They're slightly independent. They work closely with the census, but they're independent. And they have their own cities and their own townships and their own states that they want to count. One of the reasons is the amount of money at stake is vast, $1 trillion, as we know, and that's an annual number. And so if you miss out on that, you're lost. And in effect, the way we now have this census unfolding, and this is not just the immigration problem, but the immigration problem is a big piece of this, there will be at least a large number of states who do not come in close enough to the 99.9 or whatever level that the Census Bureau is shooting for, and through no fault of the Census Bureau itself. We've had COVID, you know? We've got fires burning all over California, and we've got a hurricane about to hit the Louisiana coast, right in the middle of trying to finish the census. And we're getting no backup, in effect, from the administration with respect to these rather unusual circumstances. I've said a number of times, and this will be particularly true for the immigrant population, that COVID is in charge of this census. They're simply not going to expose themselves and be talked into joining the census if they think the purpose of that is to get them out of the country. So we have a huge problem with public trust, a huge problem with quality control standards, and a really doubling down huge problem with respect to the amount of time that the Bureau is being given to conduct this intelligently.
Could be done now to improve the census in the remaining 35 days. Are there things that could be done to increase participation by hard-to-count populations and by immigrant populations, even despite all of the challenges that the wildfires and COVID and hurricanes present?
This is not the right answer, because but it's the only answer. They should have gotten the extra 4 months. They asked for it. The House of Representatives passed a bill that would allow for it. The Senate did not. But in that period, the President of the United States said, well, of course they need more time. Why wouldn't you need more time in the middle of a pandemic? In fact, I don't think we're giving them enough time. And then some new appointees were made at the Census Bureau who have political instincts rather than statistical instincts. And all of that came unraveled. And it's been lost. So I have no choice but to say, Julia, that the thing they most need now is time. And without that time, you may see high numbers. You may see numbers finally in the 90s. But that is, these are not numbers with at the level of quality that you need. And that's going to do what Jen just said. You're going to end up with more people who are going to be pushed into the undocumented category than you we have reason to believe is there. We have good estimates of it, but we do the census in order to kind of clean up all of this stuff. People have to realize that the census is the basic number against which all other numbers in the country are calibrated. I mean, serious numbers from the federal government surveys, from private surveys, from the commercial sector. All of those numbers will be calibrated to the census count at the end of this census, and that will last for 10 years until another census. So I just am worried that we're putting a lot of errors into the census, which we just can't get undone in this period of time, in 35 days. I think they will work very, very hard and have to, long hours, knocking on doors where they can, imputing, statistical modeling, a whole array of things to get as close as they can to the 100%. But that we will end up with a reasonable number, and it'll go down. It'll be applauded by the Trump administration, of course, because they applaud sort of everything that benefits them. But when you get inside of it, and that will then last. We'll never really get inside of it. We won't have a good estimate of the inaccuracy levels of inaccuracy unless the Census Bureau is allowed to go back out in the field and do some double checking, even as you get into 21. And they know how to do that. And would want to do it, and we just have to see if that's going to be in the game. This is about the apportionment count, but it's also about money, large amounts of money being shifted around in ways that simply are unfair. I'll finish with this. The tribal lands, their count's now in the 50s. In the next 35 days, we're not going to get that up into the 90s. And those are people who need money. This is health money, education money, disaster preparedness money, transportation money, and they will not get their reasonable share given the size of those populations. And that will be true for the immigrants and the cities, the places where they're concentrated, because they will be undercounted. And some of that will be error, and some of that will be not wanting to be counted. And that means that amount of money is going to go someplace else. The money is a fixed amount. It gets spent. And the question is it spent fairly, which is to say adequately across all demographic groups and all geographic areas. And I worry a lot about how well that money is going to be allocated.
Thank you very much, Ken. I have a lot more questions for you, I think, but in the interest of time, we'll move on. Sure. To Dale Ho. So Dale, you're right in the midst of a lawsuit against the Trump administration's new apportionment approach, and you were also involved in last year's cases against the citizenship question. So what are some of the key legal questions at play here, and how does this year's case differ from last year's case?
Thanks for those questions, and thank you for the invitation to participate today. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you all for taking the time to hear the three of us talk for a few minutes. This case is challenging the presidential memo, which purports to exclude undocumented immigrants entirely from the apportionment count, is very different from the citizenship question litigation that I argued in the Supreme Court last year. That case was more about process. Was the process by which the administration landed at its decision to add a citizenship question to the census, was that process appropriate? Was the administration honest about that process? Was it honest about its aims? And the Supreme Court ultimately ruled in a 5-4 decision that the administration had been dishonest about why it wanted that question on the census. The case that we're litigating now is less about process and more about the simple constitutional command in Section 2 of the 14th Amendment that apportionment in the House of Representatives and by consequence votes in the Electoral College, that those things be based on the total number of persons in each state. So last year, a case about administrative law and proper administrative procedure. This year, this case more about the fundamental guarantees in the Constitution about how the House of Representatives is constituted and how much political power in a very direct way each state gets. I think these things are tied together, though. I think, stepping away from the legal questions, this is all, in my view, just part of one lengthy scheme by this administration to reduce the political clout and access to resources of immigrant communities. We hadn't had a citizenship question on the decennial census questionnaire that went to every household since the 1950 census. That's because adding questions, particularly sensitive ones, typically reduces the response to surveys, and a question like this would disproportionately, of course, reduce responses in immigrant communities that are themselves not evenly distributed throughout the country, so it would have hit particular states and communities within states harder. The administration's own estimate was that 6.5 million people wouldn't respond to the census because of this question. The evidence that we put in at trial was that six states would be at risk of losing a seat in Congress and a vote in the Electoral College. The administration said it needed this question to enforce the Voting Rights Act. That was laughable from the perspective of someone who spends their most of their career enforcing the Voting Rights Act. We hadn't had a citizenship question on the census in the more than 50 years of the Voting Rights Act's existence. And when you looked at the documents that the administration ultimately produced, it was quite clear that for several months before the Voting Rights Act was ever discussed by this administration in relationship to the census publicly, the Secretary of Commerce and his aides were sort of angrily fuming about the fact that non-citizens and particularly undocumented immigrants are counted in the census and that that count is used for purposes of apportioning representation in the House. In May, for example, of 2017, 7 months before anyone in the administration said anything about the Voting Rights Act, Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross was angrily writing emails to his staff about asking why they hadn't already added a citizenship question to the census. So it was quite clear from the documents in the case that the Voting Rights Act had nothing to do with why the administration sought to add the question, and the Supreme Court agreed with that and struck the effort down. What the case last year did not resolve is what was the administration's true purpose in adding the citizenship question. And I think the presidential memo, which is seeking to exclude undocumented immigrants, answers that question. It is to delete people from the count and drain their resources, drain their communities of representation and resources. And as Professor Van Hook, I think pointed out, this effort risks not only excluding undocumented immigrants, but excluding a lot of people with legal status and even U.S. citizens on the back end if you're using administrative records. I think on the front end, it also creates those risks because it deters census participation from mixed status households and people who live in immigrant communities. It's already difficult to perform census outreach this year for all of the reasons that Professor Pruitt identified: the pandemic, the political climate, the shortened time frame for census non-response follow-up, and our clients whom we're representing, community groups in a number of states with large immigrant populations, are telling us that they are encountering difficulties encouraging census participation, not just because of those factors, but because of the presidential memo, that a lot of people are saying, what difference does it make? Why should I fill out the census when I or my family or my community aren't going to be counted anyway? So we think it's important to get this resolved, not just before the apportionment, which happens next year, but before the end of non-response follow-up operations at the end of September. We've asked the court hearing our case to issue a ruling before then. The motion that we filed will be fully briefed on Friday, and it's conceivable that we'll get a ruling from the court within the next 2 or 3 weeks after that.
Great. Thank you, Dale, for that explanation and update on the status of things. We are starting to see some questions come in, but before we turn to the audience questions, I just wanted to ask, so Ken, you had raised, you know, low response rates in some communities, and Dale, you just mentioned that this new approach, this new memo is deterring responses in immigrant communities. So how will we know if the 2020 census is viable? Is there a particular response rate that would say that this is an adequate census, and how do we know what the response rate really is? And what happens if the data is just too poor to trust? Is there any remedy for the various uses of the census for allocating government funds, for apportioning congressional seats, or for creating valid benchmarks for government surveys? I don't know, Ken, if you would maybe want to start with this, and then I'll pass it on to the other panel members.
Certainly. The answer is yes. There are a lot of measures that we can use, simple ones like looking at the structure of the census in 2000 and 2010 for the same period in the sequence. Where are they with respect to where we were in those earlier censuses? Various other quality controls. We sort of sometimes send the census back to states and cities, saying, this is where we are with respect to your count. Do you see anything in it problematic? Certainly about the group quarters, we can do that. I'm part of a group that's asked for there to be appointed by the Congress a independent, non-political organization which can do some predetermined metrics of the quality of the census. Let me interrupt myself for a second and say that the census itself has obligations to only produce accurate numbers. There's a lot of law that makes that their obligation because they are so influential. And so they have to have measures of what qualifies for a accurate census. And we could put together right now, and there are groups having this conversation, a small set of metrics that would say at the end of the day, guess what? We didn't make it for one reason or another. Are we made it in this part of the world, in this part of the country, but not that part of the country? Are we made it for everyone except the immigrants, or except for the housing quarters, living quarters in the college towns and so forth? And then I guess what I would hope is that the country would have a discussion about what to do next. Now, that is enormously naive. The next period, of course, is the period of the election, which is going to consume everything now until November 3rd and maybe beyond, as we know. So I don't even see a window for that. But I don't see any option for that, where we actually identify the measures that would tell us. And let me just finish this by saying the cost of not having a good census is really high. It means chambers of commerce miscalculated the age structure of their cities and towns. And guess what? They plan for a much younger audience or a much older audience, and they're wrong. Or you've got a measure of educational ambitions, educational accomplishments, and you get that wrong. And you got the wrong number of school teachers in your town. Or you miscalculated where the veterans are. And so you've built the veterans' hospitals in the wrong place, all for a decade. And the country will be littered with these mistakes made because the fundamental numbers were a mistake. So the cost of this is high, and the standards are available to us if we put them in place. It would require the Census Bureau to cooperate, to show us their daily counts of various kinds of, under various kinds of circumstances and situations. I know the Census Bureau well enough to know that it would want to do that, but I also know that they're under very tight control right now.
Dale, what about on the apportionment side or on the litigation front? If the census doesn't look good, are there indications that it's not of high quality? Are there legal options of what comes next?
There are some, but I'd say that I think they're challenging. Census data is treated by courts as presumptively, I think, as Ken was noting, kind of it's the benchmark against which other kinds of statistics are measured. And so courts generally treat census data as presumptively valid. Now, there is a constitutional obligation by an administration to conduct a complete and accurate census. It's awfully difficult to figure out a precise legal standard for what would constitute a complete and accurate census, because every census, you know, has its imperfections, and, you know, defining precisely when those errors rise to the level of a constitutional violation is quite difficult. And then when it comes to the timing of the census numbers and how they're used, a lot of that is defined by statute. So I think litigation would be difficult if we get to bad results when the enumeration numbers come in at the end of the year. It's conceivable that a future Congress could change those statutes to permit for some adjustment. So that's where I think the energy should probably be focused if we get to that point, because I do think litigation would be difficult.
And Jenny, are there ways of knowing how well the census covered immigrants in particular? And is there anything that could be done if this, you know, decennial benchmark for our data going forward has a skewed count of an immigrant population?
Well, in general, there's ongoing programs at the Census Bureau for assessing the coverage and evaluation of the census. So, you know, I think that the thing that's going to come out first is estimates of net undercount or net enumeration. So, there you could have, you know, I think those numbers are supposed to come out next, early next year. And, you know, that should tell us in general whether Hispanics or Blacks or whites or children or people who are older and elderly have higher or low levels of representation in the census. But that doesn't tell us anything about people who are omitted versus those who are duplicates in the census. And I think that's going to take some of the stuff that Ken was talking about, you know, that those sort of coverage and evaluation programs. And I'm not sure where they are on that. Maybe Ken could say something more about that. Because, you know, and then I guess you did ask me about immigrants per se. And I think those are especially hard numbers to come by. Sometimes it's people have evaluated coverage of immigrants by looking at special surveys of immigrants and then assessing their participation in the census that way. Another way of doing it is to look at vital records, for example, the numbers of births to mothers who are immigrants or the numbers of deaths to immigrants. And if there's dips or something like that in those numbers compared to the census numbers, that could give us a signal about what's going on and how bad it is for that group.
Great. We have a few different questions from the audience related to this method for identifying unauthorized immigrants in the census responses. And I'm not sure, Jenny or Ken, maybe you might want to take a stab at this. So the question, one of the questions is the Census Bureau actually trying to determine at an individual level whether each and every census respondent is legally present or an unauthorized immigrant, or would they be doing that at the state level or county level or some other geographic area? And if it is at the individual level, are there privacy issues here? And are there any concerns for immigration ramifications for those who are identified by the administrative records as unauthorized immigrants? Jenny, do you want to maybe take the first stab at that? And then Ken, if you have anything to add, I'll turn to you.
You know, I'm actually not sure, because I don't think there's been a methodology that's been published about how they're going to be doing these assignments. But you're shaking your head, Dale, so it sounds like no. Yeah, so I don't know, you know, I'm guessing that they're going to have to put people in a box, right? They're going to have to put somebody assign everybody to one of the boxes of, you know, legal status or citizenship.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, and then you're going to have to be able to cut this up into different jurisdictions. So certainly by state, but.
Dale, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, we don't really know what the administration's planning on doing, other than that they have an official policy of excluding all undocumented immigrants from the apportionment count. We know from the citizenship question litigation that when asked how to determine the citizenship status of census respondents, the Census Bureau said the best way to do that would be through the administrative records that Jenny was referencing earlier, Social Security Administration records, and I think they were going to supplement them with Department of Homeland Security, and then we're starting to try to collect things like DMV databases, which are notoriously inaccurate or out of date. But setting all that aside, that collection of administrative records was not to determine legal status, but citizenship or non-citizenship. Now, it's conceivable that for the people identified as non-citizens, there is some legal status information in some of those records. I don't think that would be in the SSA records, for example, so maybe some of the Homeland Security records. So it does sort of beg the question, are they just going to anyone that they can't link to an administrative record that establishes citizenship or legal status, are they just going to classify those people bluntly as undocumented? That would mean, I think as Jenny identified, about 30 million people who can't be matched to administrative records, far beyond any, I think, credible estimate of the undocumented population in the country, probably about three times the size of most estimates. In the course of our current litigation, the government has, for example, has referenced other records that they might look at. They might look at detention records or records of people who are in removal proceedings. That's a pretty small subset of people who could be described as undocumented, right? If you assume for a moment that all those people are, which I want to get back to in a second, but you know, there are maybe about 50,000 people in detention at a given moment, maybe 3 million people in some stage of removal proceedings in a given moment, and you're talking about an undocumented population that's about 11 million people. Pew's, you know, survey, most recent survey on like length of time that people have been here is that the median length of time that an undocumented adult has been in the United States is over 15 years, that over two-thirds of undocumented immigrants have been here for over, undocumented adults have been here for over a decade. So you're talking about not just a small slice of people, but probably a very unrepresentative slice. But then let's look at that slice. Being in detention does not automatically render you undocumented, right? You can have legal status. Even there have been a few high-profile cases of United States citizens ending up in detention, but leaving that aside, being in detention just means that the government has made an initial determination that you should be in detention, but it doesn't mean that you are in fact or ever will be determined to be undocumented. The same goes for people in removal proceedings. A lot of people in removal proceedings are not under a final order of removal, and then of course people under such an order frequently successfully challenge those orders. So if, you know, the government could try to take some kind of broad brush approach where someone in detention or someone in removal is going to be deemed undocumented, but that wouldn't match up with the criteria that they're purporting to use to exclude people from the apportionment. So right now, it's hard to know exactly what the government is planning on doing. The Census Bureau appears to have been out of the loop on this entirely. The Census Bureau director, Steve Dillingham, didn't even know that the presidential memo was coming. He learned about it the same way all of us did via the media. So it really looks like there's been a kind of takeover of the Bureau's policy by these political appointees whose new positions have been created, and that the professionalized leadership and even the political appointee who's the director of the Bureau are out of the loop.
Ken, would you want to touch on the privacy aspect of that question? So if people are identified at the individual level correctly or incorrectly as unauthorized immigrants, are there any immigration or other legal ramifications for that?
Well, the people don't understand about the census. The census doesn't care about people. It cares about statistical records. You know, it wants, when it says he wants to count everybody, they really mean they want to give everybody who has a statistical record, who has an age, who has a an ethnicity, who has a citizenship state, whatever it is about them that we are counting them to learn about, whether offered phraseology, that's what matters. They don't care about individuals. They care about statistical groupings because that's how we make public policy. So it's very scary to have an initiative which actually goes after the individual identity, especially if it's out of records that are not under the same sort of privacy controls as the Census Bureau's records. So if I were an illegal immigrant, I would be very anxious about getting anywhere close to the census this year. No matter how long I've been here and how many other censuses I've gone through that worked, I don't feel good about this one. That's what does it. So you're absolutely right to ask the question. Technically, no. Technically, they're not going to be individually identified people. And we have privacy practices to do that. Without going through the technical, it's now called differential privacy. It's quite complicated. But there are ways to protect everybody's individual identity. Because the Census Bureau actually doesn't care. It only cares about getting the larger numbers down to the block level or census tract level and so forth accurate. And they know how to do that. But the administration is pressing them to give to count everybody with an identity. So we don't know what happens to that data file is the problem.
But there are very strict laws in place that prohibit the Census Bureau from sharing information to, say, law enforcement or immigration enforcement authorities. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And I can tell you in 2000, I made a call to the head of what was then the INS, in effect, National Security. It's not the same thing we got after, of course, after 9/11, the much bigger apparatus, and said, you know, we're about to do the census. We're about to go into the field. Do you mind just sort of not doing any arrests or any raids during that period until we get a complete count of the population? They said, oh, sure, we can wait back. We don't have to do this now. It's not urgent. Go do your census. Inconceivable today. That would be the answer, is the point. That's how much has changed in just two decades.
So we have another question for you, Dale, related to kind of the timeline of the census and the current lawsuit. So it asks, does Congress have to pass a statutory extension of the census for the lawsuit to succeed? Or how does this, 35 remaining days interact with your lawsuit?
So just to be clear, our lawsuit is about the exclusion of undocumented immigrants from the apportionment count. There are other lawsuits which deal with the cutoff for non-response follow-up operations, but we're not counsel in any of those. Those lawsuits are arguing that there is a constitutional issue here, that the Constitution requires a complete and accurate count of the population, and that under current deadlines, given the pandemic and everything else that's happened, that's not going to be possible with a September 30th deadline. And so the statutory deadlines have to yield to the kind of, superior constitutional demand for a complete count. That's the kind of first line of defense here. It's a hard argument, but these are pretty extreme circumstances. I think easier solution would have been for Congress to do what the Census Bureau and the administration initially requested before they did their 180, which is to extend the timing for the completion of the count, which would allow for an extension of non-response follow-up operations. It's always conceivable, though, that if those numbers are flawed, you could get a ruling from the court that requires some kind of additional, outreach or a subsequent statute by a new Congress, perhaps, to correct the count. But we're really in kind of unprecedented territory when we start considering options like those.
So that brings up a related question, which is, if Trump does lose the presidential election in November, are there any specific things, quality controls, policies that a Biden administration could do, starting in late January next year to rectify the census count? I don't know if you would want to start on that one.
The answer is sort of yes and no. Anything it did would be unprecedented, but that doesn't keep it from happening. it would play out quite differently politically if it's not just the White House, but it's also the Senate, of course, because the Senate's in a position to be able to block almost any activities that the administration initiates if it wants to. So it's a huge, big question to which there's no kind of clear answer. I would say that the Census Bureau itself, I know its culture well. I know the people, not obviously as well as I did when I was there, but there's a culture there which says, you know, we have to tell the country what we have found out. That's our job. And if that means we did not count nearly as well as we had hoped to, or we missed the under 5-year-olds, you mentioned the children earlier, or we missed the tribal lands, or we, you know, or the Hispanic population. And we know that. Only the census can know if there are serious flaws in a census. And they are a transparent organization. So one of the big backdrop questions is whether the Census Bureau will be able to behave according to its own standards, or will be prevented from behaving that way. And then we're into legal land deeper than we've ever experienced. There's no precedent for how to handle a court case like that, where an agency was prevented from actually sharing the information it had about the society, which it was responsible to deliver to the society. And that we just have to see what's going to happen in the next term. And the other thing about the election date, as now has been said numerous times, we can have an election date that's all over on November 3rd, but we don't have a decision about it because of vote countings. And, you know, remember, after all, we didn't finally decide in 2001 until into January. You just ask a big question to which there's no answer, I'm afraid. Nope.
Taylor, Jenny, no, would either of you want to add anything onto that about what a new administration could do?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the legal requirements would be, you know, in terms of, I think the one thing that I wonder about is that adjustment is something that the courts would allow of a census, not for apportionment, but for other purposes, and whether that would be something that could be pushed forward with a new administration.
Yeah, Jenny's right about that. The apportionment count is in its own space, if you will, odd constitutional space, with all the provisions that of course, have already been articulated. But other kinds of things, like the allocation of the money, you could say, oh, well, this spent a year really sorting it out and making sure it's going to the correct places and so forth, because you could do that without having by drawing samples of the population. We have demographic estimates all over the place about the current state of the population based upon survey data. And the Constitution doesn't prevent using survey data for those purposes. Therefore, I think they would be used. The Constitution, according to the Supreme Court, only prevents the survey data from being used on the apportionment count. And so the apportionment count may last for 10 years, but the other pieces of this that are so critical could be adjusted without any big legal fight if the country were willing to do it.
Yeah.
So turning back to our current Congress and our current president, what role has Congress been playing in the census in oversight or in considering legislation? And are there other roles that you would hope for it to play? Dale, would you want to start on that one?
Sure. When it comes to, I think, it's a little hard for me to talk about given the ongoing litigation, but you know, the House has tried to exercise some oversight with some oversight hearings. But I think when it comes to things like the deadline, making sure that the Bureau has the resources it needs and the time that it needs, Congress has essentially abdicated here, and the administration is going to proceed with its plans unless litigation proceeds.
Ken, would you want to weigh in on that question about Congress's role?
The House has been very active. as Dale just said, intelligently so, and the Senate has not. The Senate has simply not moved forward with any kind of solutions to the current state of the we all know, everybody in the country is paying attention and reading the papers, knows this is a very vulnerable census right now because of COVID, not just because of the politics, but certainly because of the COVID, and then plus the politics, and then plus the disasters and so forth. They stopped the census for about two and a half months. They had to during the first warm-up and going initiation of COVID. They had no choice but to get out of the field, thinking they would be able to make it up later. I describe it this way, that for a while they were pushing, and then Congress came along and said, look, we're going to give you four more months. And that's like being told, it's a marathon. Pace yourself. Get it right. Do your quality controls and so forth. And then a couple of weeks later, you say, oh, no, we made a mistake. You really have to run a 100-yard dash in 9 seconds. And that's what they're trying to do now. And so it's very difficult to know where the problems are going to be at the end of the day today. Too much is happening right now. New things are happening daily. I just got an estimate from somebody in my own area, a numerator, saying that they may close down a week earlier than they were given. So if that's going on in different parts of the country that we don't even know about it, it just means it's not under control right now.
So we have a question about the timeline for the current legal case. What is your sense of how quickly you might expect a decision? Do you expect a decision in time for there to be appeals and eventually a Supreme Court decision before the December 31st timeline that the administration has set for delivering the apportionment counts?
You see me gritting my teeth because after having gone through expedited Supreme Court proceedings last year in the citizenship question case, I'm not hungry for the prospect of doing that again. So I should first say there are multiple cases on this issue, right? So ours is in New York. There's a case in California, a case in DC, a case in Maryland, and one in Massachusetts. The three moving the most quickly are the ones in New York, California, and DC, with New York moving the fastest. As I think said before, we told the court that it's important that the memo be ruled unconstitutional before the end of census follow-up efforts on September 30th, and have asked for very quick resolution of the case, or at least the principal legal claim in the case. It will be fully briefed as of Friday, and the court really would be within its right to rule at any time thereafter. Without a hearing, just on the papers, it's possible we'll have some kind of hearing and argument. It's not before a single judge, it's before a specially constituted three-judge court. That's also true of the California and DC cases. And the reason I flag that is such courts have direct appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. So if we get a fast ruling in September in our favor, it's quite conceivable that the administration will seek to appeal in the Supreme Court on some sort of expedited time frame. From our perspective, this is a kind of open and shut legal issue. So it shouldn't need that. we'll see. It's conceivable that we don't get a ruling as quickly as we want it to, because the court finds that there isn't a direct connection between the presidential memo and non-response follow-up. The court could decide that this just affects what number is used for the apportionment, the total population, or the total population minus some, number of undocumented immigrants, and that can always be corrected somewhere down the road. So it's conceivable that we don't get a ruling in September and the case ends up moving at kind of a more normal pace. I guess we'll know within a month or so, but I would expect to know even sooner than that, within 2 or 3 weeks.
Great, thank you for that. We will all be watching what happens in your case and in the others. We had a lot of questions, unfortunately, that we didn't get to because of time, but I just wanted to thank all of you watching for joining us today for this important conversation. And thank you so much to Dale, Jenny, and Ken for joining us today. This has been really enlightening, and there's a lot to worry about, a lot to watch, and to see how it develops. And if anybody on the webinar has not yet filled out your census form, I highly encourage you to do so, and to encourage your family members and friends to do so as well. The audio for today's webinar will be available at our website, www.migrationpolicy.org/events. The related commentary by Randy Capps, Jenny Van Hook, and I is available at our website or at the link that you see on the screen right now. If any reporters are watching today and would like to talk more, you can contact Michelle Mittelstadt at 202-266-1910 or at this email address. And we encourage you to receive MPI updates by following the link that's shown on the screen as well. Thank you again, everyone, for joining us, and have a good afternoon.